for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. and Russia reached their most extensive nuclear arms control deal in decades. The head of the U.N.'s mission to Afghanistan met with a delegation from a top insurgent group. The meeting happened just days after Afghanistan's president held peace talks with another delegation. And the Vatican is confronted with an escalating clerical sex abuse scandal. Joining us for the international portion of our Friday News Roundup, Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and Paul Richter of the Los Angeles Times and Tribune Newspapers. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Morning. Good morning.
Paul Richter, tell us about the U.S.-Russia nuclear arms deal.
Well, President Obama and Russian President Medvedev had a phone call today that basically finalizes this deal, which is a major step for the U.S. and a major step for Russia. It will reduce deployed strategic warheads by about 30%. It does a lot of other things for the White House as well. It's a tangible foreign policy accomplishment. He's been looking for one for some time. And it also opens the way for other steps in the Obama nuclear agenda. The president has put a lot of emphasis on a series of treaties and steps by the U.S. to show that we're willing to do more, to control nuclear weapons, to phase them out. And he's hoping that other countries around the world, medium-sized countries that might want nuclear weapons, will take that as a signal that they should move away from nuclear as well.
So big deal for the Obama administration, big deal for the whole world, Nancy.
Yeah, and also a big deal for U.S.-Russian relations in that there was some concern that Russia would not be as open to this given the discussions of missile defense and the United States placing its programs in Poland and the Czech Republic, given its own sort of anxiety about its own aging weapons program, that they wouldn't be as apt to agree to reduce their weapons. So, as Paul says, it is a tangible victory, and hopefully it changes the dialogue on nuclear weapons worldwide, particularly as we're talking about concerns these days about what's happening with Pakistan's program and the instability around them right now.
And Daniel Dombey, now it has to go to the Senate for ratification. Is that going to happen?
It probably is going to happen, but it's not going to happen for free. The Obama administration realizes it's got a very difficult task here, and indeed this agreement was harder to reach than they thought. You're going to have to overcome some Republican skepticism, and already to do that, the Obama administration's announced that it's increasing spending on the nuclear deterrent in this country. It's going to have to do an awful lot to win round Republican doubters, and those doubters are going to get going to be even more important for the other more ambitious parts of the Obama administration nuclear agenda.
So, but in the end, do you feel they'll get what they want here?
I think this will be ratified, but there are a couple of big outliers then. If there is any other sudden deterioration in the U.S.-Russia relationship, and that can come out of the blue, this could immediately just put this into the cooler. Republicans are also going to be looking very carefully on the language on missile defense. There may well be some language in the preamble. And in addition, there you have the whole question of Iran. If there is a Republican perception that Russia is not doing its bit on Iran, they're not going to hurry. Obama needs 67 votes. At the moment, he has 59. And after November, he's going to have fewer. He doesn't have unlimited time. He doesn't have unlimited votes.
You mentioned November. How much is that going? That is, the elections in this country. How much is that going to play into ratification?
it will be a substantial issue. And let's face it, the Republicans in the Senate are in a bad mood these days. Time itself is going to be a big issue because the last two go-arounds on treaty ratification have taken, one took 9 months and the other one took more than a year. So trouble ahead, perhaps.
And do you agree with that, Nancy?
I agree. It makes me nervous. The Pentagon correspondent to me makes me nervous because, as was pointed out earlier, U.S.-Russian relationship right now is very prickly and things could change very quickly. And it also comes at a time when we're talking about, as a country, how to deal with Iran. And Russia is plays a key role in that. And so that all these moving parts are moving at the same time, it makes it all the more sensitive.
And what about the Iraq election results? What's the latest there, Daniel?
Well, we're still waiting for the final results, but it's a very interesting story because you have two men who both want to be prime minister, who can't stand each other, who have very different profiles, who have both served in that office, virtually neck to neck, And this is actually a very, very important contest between Ayad Alawi and Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister. Maliki feels very strongly that he's the man who saved Iraq, that he took on the security problems in Basra and Sadr City and so on, and he has strong Shia support. Alawi has reinvented himself as a more secular kind of figure and gets on much better with the Iraqi neighbours, particularly Syria and Saudi Arabia and so on. There's concerns, some people voice that if Maliki made it, it would be seen as a real blow by the Sunni Arabs who would respond accordingly and be bad for relations. On the other hand, Maliki says he has a record of success. So there's an awful lot to play for, and there's always a possibility that someone else can come from outside, as happened when Maliki, who was previously someone I'd never heard of, came there. But it's a very important issue, all the more so for the fact that it doesn't get the attention it deserves.
I think the other thing is that there's real angst on the streets in the streets of Iraq about what happens when these elections the results come out, which are scheduled for 7 p.m. local time in Iraq tonight, which is in the middle of the morning for us in the United States. There's a real angst about how the transition to power will happen and whether it will lead to more violence, given that Maliki and Jalal Talabani called for a recount, called the elections fraudulent, whether the elections will be seen as legitimate, and also because these elections really galvanized and re-empowered Muqtada al-Sadr and his bloc. As we talk about the jostling between Alawi and Maliki, Sadr comes out pretty strong in this. He will have more seats than any other member, and that fundamentally changes the dynamic as well. So it's a very interesting time. It will be months before we have this government seated, which is a dangerous place for Iraq to be in, given the precarious security situation, all while the United States plans to rapidly draw down its forces from 96,000 right today to about 50 by the end of August.
Paul Reichter.
The comeback of Ayad Alawi is an interesting story. He was prime minister of Iraq early in the American occupation. He left office with seemingly very little public support, secular Shia, kind of a strong man known to have past ties with the CIA. Now he's possibly back. Interesting personal story.
You know, the interesting thing is from the Iraqi perspective, Alawi is seen as an American puppet and Maliki is seen as the Iranian one. And so it's an interesting dynamic about who's going to emerge and what that means. And what Sadr really represents is the Iraqi movement in a way. And so those are the three sort of powers that are vying for their place in the post-America Iraq, if you will.
Well, let's talk about Iran and whether the United States is softening its stand on sanctions toward Iran. Paul.
Well, U.S. officials still say publicly that they want to get as much as they can. They're contending that they have a lot of support from the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council. But it seems clear if you talk to diplomats who are involved in the discussions that they are setting aside some of the tougher kinds of sanctions proposals that would probably get strong resistance from Russia, China, and from these non-permanent members of the Security Council who also have a lot of reservations about strong sanctions. You're talking Brazil, Turkey, Lebanon. So I think what we're going to see is that some of the diplomats involved say that the what emerges from the Security Council may be a fairly weak, fairly watered-down document in order to build strong, broad support. And then the more teeth may come in unilateral and other sanctions that will follow from a coalition of the willing.
So it's the UK and Germany who've been pressing the US to back down somewhat.
I think actually it's primarily with Russia and China in mind that the US has been backing down. I think, to be honest, this watering down of text is all part of a normal game. The US can try and get those unilateral actions, having said they tried at the UN and failed, so there's a bit of strategy behind it. But the fact is, it's very important that this is a game as usual, because we were told this was going to be different. We were told that this was going to be tougher. We were told that this was going to be more united, and that it would be wholly separate from the experience we've had three times at the UN before, when sanctions have been passed and Iran has proceeded with its nuclear program regardless. We are going to see, I think it's fairly clear now, sanctions which are pretty similar to the sanctions that are already passed. We're going to see an international community that by no means can be depicted as fast-moving and forceful, even if at the end of the day it's united. And I have to say, there's no particular reason why you think that Iran would suddenly halt its nuclear program in response to this.
So what are the sanctions the U.S. backed down on?
Well, I think it's a matter of the degree of sanctions. And I have to say, as I watch this, I find what's interesting is how Obama's handled this. He went from talking about negotiations to really approaching this in a much more nuanced way.
Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Paul Richter. He's diplomatic correspondent at the LA Times and Tribune newspapers. Nancy Youssef is Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy newspapers. Daniel Dombey is U.S. diplomatic correspondent for Financial Times. We do invite your calls, your questions, comments. Do join us. Let's talk about the increasing tensions going on between the U.S. and Israel. I gather there were some meetings yesterday between President Obama and Mr. Netanyahu, Nancy.
Yes, Netanyahu was in Washington this week. He spoke before AIPAC and talked about that Jerusalem is the Israeli capital on the heels of an announcement of 1,600 homes being put up in what's traditionally considered the Palestinian area of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. There were several meetings at the White House. This was not the usual reception that the head of the Israeli government gets in Washington. It was very toned down and very tense between the president and Netanyahu, and at the end of the day, there was no resolution to it. And Netanyahu is meeting today with his government to talk about the results of those meetings. It's one of the most openly tense relationships we've ever seen between the Israeli government and the United States government. And things now sort of remain in the air in terms of where things go next, other than the Israelis are steadfast in putting up the settlements despite the Obama administration's objections. Remember in Egypt that President Obama had said that the United States did not want to see new settlements. And so it's really pitted Netanyahu against between the Obama administration and the right-wing coalition partners in his government.
It was interesting. NPR reported this morning on the fact that there was this meeting between the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and then President Obama left without inviting Netanyahu to go to dinner with him. Daniel.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt at all that this is a relationship that is very bad at a personal level. In fact, there is a certain concern on both sides that it's not strategic consideration. Sometimes it's just mere anger with the other that fuels this. I mean, President Obama, by all accounts, was livid when he heard about the latest settlement announcement. And that explained why Secretary Clinton was so tough with Mr. Netanyahu in a phone call straight afterwards. But I think, actually, if you look at it, there's actually one particularly important issue, which is how much are these two people supported by their public opinions? President Obama is pushing a case which is not necessarily very strongly supported throughout the U.S. You have the extraordinary situation where Mr. Netanyahu was greeted very, very with open arms on Capitol Hill, and he was cheered to the rafters at AIPAC, which is rather surprising if you consider he's a foreign leader at odds with the United States government. How much is Mr. Obama supported by U.S. public opinion in his position, and how much is Mr. Netanyahu supported by public opinion in a battle with the U.S., the ultimate guarantor of Israeli security? In
Paul Richter.
There seem to be accumulating signs that President Obama feels so strongly personally, perhaps more strongly than some of his own aides. Joe Biden 2 weeks ago had pretty much looked like he had put the issue back on a positive footing with the Israelis. As he left Israel to come back to the U.S., Hillary Clinton was on the phone at Obama's instructions, basically chewing out Netanyahu. Some analysts who are close to this say Obama is acting as his own desk officer on this issue.
It's funny you mention that, because Secretary of Defense Robert Gates had a briefing yesterday and was asked about this, and there was a pregnant pause, and he said, you know, military-to-military relations between the United States and Israel have never been stronger. And so you can sort of start to feel the tension in terms of where the administration as a whole stands, Obama versus even key members in his cabinet. It's an interesting dynamic that's developing.
But what happens to the peace process in all of this? Maybe nothing.
Well, I think you have to bear in mind that the peace process we're talking about is a real case of back to the future. What people are talking about is what is known as proximity talks, which is indirect talks. Now, this is something that takes us back to the early 1990s, before the Oslo Accord. So even the way ahead seems a pretty difficult way ahead. And I think the fundamental reason, and the reason why the Obama administration feels so personal about it, and let's be under no misunderstandings, this time it really is personal, is the sense that with the settlements increasing, with the West, with East Jerusalem, with the subject of ever more constructions, with the West Bank bifurcated by lots of roads, the time for a two-state solution is running out.
When
the time
you,
for a viable Palestinian state,
you know,
is running out.
Daniel, when you call this a personal situation between the two men, the political is personal and the personal is political. The Israeli press is calling this a full-blown crisis. Netanyahu flew home to apparently a blast of media derision after he was deprived of the so-called normal trappings granted to a visiting leader at the White House. And there was this second meeting that Netanyahu insisted on. How did that happen, and why was he insisting on it?
Well, I think it's fairly clear that the Obama administration and President Obama particularly made concrete demands on Mr. Netanyahu. Hillary Clinton had done that in her phone call just a week before or so. Mr. Obama did as well. The US believes it has a workaround, which is it knows that no Israeli government at the moment would declare a settlement freeze in East Jerusalem. It just says, just don't make any announcements, which is more or less the same thing, but without a clear and ringing declaration. Mr. Obama made that demand. He made several other demands in terms of confidence-building measures. Netanyahu clearly asked for some time to think about it, confer with his people, came back with an answer. That answer was not to the satisfaction of the U.S. administration.
When we talk about the Israeli public, we talk a lot about this whole kerfuffle, if you will, in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But I think for the Israeli public, one of the reasons that they value the United States relationship, particularly now, is Iran and their concerns about Iran and its potential threat to Israel. So I think that's an ancillary but important undercurrent that's driving a lot of the concern among the Israeli public.
All right, go ahead, Paul.
The peace process has been in a tough state for years now. I think, though, that Obama also has his eye on the broader regional context. He's convinced, and some people in the Pentagon are convinced, too, that if there's a stalemate, if there's no progress between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that's also going to spill over and cause larger problems with all the rest of the Muslim world.
And, of course, we're also dealing with a visit to Pakistan on the part of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. There are those who are saying that the relationship between Pakistan and the U.S. is at a high point now.
That's right. One of the things that the United States is trying to convey to Pakistan is that we, the United States, are not only interested in you because of the issue of Islamic extremism and militancy and the al-Qaeda threat, that we're interested in a broader range of issues. And there was an effort this week to really convey that image or that message. We heard it with General Kiani's visit to Washington this week. We heard it as the United States began negotiations on some sort of nuclear agreement. We heard it in this 56-page sort of wish list that the Pakistanis presented to the United States of the kinds of weapons and helicopters and other military aid that they'd like to get from the United States. I think we're seeing an evolution of it. And for the Pakistanis, the most important thing I think they want to hear is that that Pakistan is not just a tool towards your fight against extremism.
All I would add to that is that the words you perhaps should be most wary of as a journalist are, this time it's different. And those are the words they're saying about the Pakistani-U.S. relationship. The Pakistanis say it's not a transaction-based relationship anymore, but here's a lot of aid they want, including a nuclear deal, which, to be honest, I think very few diplomats think that Pakistan has any chance of concluding, given its history of nuclear proliferation. The U.S. says it's not just concerned about security, but when are you going to invade North? When are you going to send your troops into North Waziristan? So they immediately revert to the lines of the past. And I would say one thing is the Pakistani military is a very, very big actor in this. And the Pakistani military is very far from satisfied. They think that they've got a whole list of weapons they want. They think only a tiny number of those have actually been given to them by the U.S.
There's an interesting gap between what's being said publicly and what's going on privately in this whole thing. There was a very positive photo op and press conference between Hillary Clinton and the Pakistani foreign minister the other day where they basically said everything's hunky-dory. But a senior Pakistani official said this morning that they'd only gotten out of their seven major requests for military help, they'd only gotten between 0.2 and 0.7% of those. And Qureshi, before he left for the U.S., had a press conference with a bunch of Pakistani reporters and said, those Americans have talked the talk, but now they've got to walk the walk and deliver that equipment.
I just want to add to this idea of asking the Pakistanis to send troops to North Waziristan. The Pakistani response is, we are doing more. We're arresting more militants. We're doing it. Now, the question becomes, are they doing it because they have a fundamental shift in strategy vis-a-vis Afghanistan, or are they trying to sort of play both roles, where they're keeping a person at the table during the negotiations on Afghanistan and at the same time keeping their armed proxies in the game, if you will. And so I think the United States knows, practically speaking, sending troops to North Waziristan is not an option. They've at least this year, the Pakistanis have said that, and now there's an effort to sort of go about this not always in the most forthright way, mm-hmm. but a more nuanced way. Mm.
General Kayani has been on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in Washington this week, and he has a big slideshow where he shows quite how much the Pakistanis have increased their military effort in 2008 and 2009. That's true, but he also says they're stretched. And the other thing, just to make clear, is everyone has their eye on Afghanistan. Since President Obama came out with that date of July 2011 and beginning a drawdown, even though he said it was just the beginning of a process, not an end, everyone is starting to think about an Afghanistan after the Americans. And that adds to the complexities and tensions in the area.
All right, let's talk about the Roman Catholic Church. There are reports that Pope Benedict XVI, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, refused to defrock an American priest who had been accused of molesting boys, and that despite receiving letters from a number of American bishops pleading with him to act on the matter, he failed to do so. Nancy.
That's right. This is a story that broke in the New York Times this week, and it's really once again shocked about the Catholic community, and I think it's raised questions about how the now Pope approaches these issues, his commitment to him, the tenor of this church under his leadership, and what constitutes acceptable behavior in the Catholic Church and what his role is. What's interesting is that the Vatican has taken this as such a personal attack on the Pope itself, the Pope himself, and that's sort of a witch hunt campaign against him, and that that they were different times, and that he tried to deal with it in the way the times were, and are trying to put some context on this, but trying to make that argument into an American audience is not resonating. So once again, I think the Church finds itself in a crisis about what its relationship is with its American followers, given the sordid past.
Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Paul Richter.
The broader issue for the Vatican is how responsive are they going to be to public pressure on this issue? Are they going to provide, you know, information broadly, or are they going to really decide that there's a limit to how far they're going to go? So far, I think they've been reacted fairly traditionally in what they've released.
Do you believe they will go further, Daniel Dombey?
I think this process is a drip-by-drip process, and it is clearly going to demand more steps by the Vatican. Let's remember, this isn't just the U.S. scandal. There's a German scandal. There's a Irish scandal. Bishops have resigned in Ireland. There have been payments in the millions and billions in some case. We're talking about thousands of cases. I think what it cuts down to is that this is a culture clash in many ways. You are dealing with a priesthood that sees itself as a part in many ways, but you're also dealing with a culture, a religion, and I tread very carefully here, which puts repentance at its absolute heart. And the issue is when is this an issue for repentance and for someone to be removed from their clerical duties, even sometimes temporarily, and when is it a question for penal law? These are cases, to be clear, that took place largely in the 60s and 70s, but the question is, the traditional attitude towards the Catholic Church often is repentance and prayer. In today's world, many people think that this is, knowing what we know about paedophilia, that is simply not good enough.
You know, we took the time, one of our producers took the time to look at Protestant cases of paedophilia. And in fact, in 2008, there were something approaching 268 cases taken to lawyers. And one wonders whether this will proceed up the ladder to legal retribution if they cannot get satisfaction from the Vatican. I found it interesting that the Pope's letter on this addressed only the Irish situation, made no mention of what had happened in Germany, and that the bishops in Germany, were very unhappy, Paul Richter.
Yes, it's interesting to see the spread of this issue through Europe and to wonder whether it will replicate the experience in the U.S. where it has moved onto much more of a legal footing. That's a question still unresolved.
So what should the Vatican be doing now, in anyone's view, to help to rectify this situation? Daniel.
Well, I think many people have said actually the U.S. situation, I mean, before the latest Milwaukee claims, is an example for the European churches to follow, that you do need transparency, that it is important to involve legal authorities. Let's not forget that the Vatican itself is a state and is a sovereign authority. It's in Europe, it may be harder to realize that you need to let loose that sovereign authority if crimes have been committed. But crimes clearly have been committed, and therefore openness and legal recourse appear to me to be relevant.
I think the reason why there are so many questions is when the American scandal broke, it was Pope John Paul II at the helm, and now it's Pope Benedict, and we've already seen a major change in tenor, and I think that's why there's a real question about how the Church is going to respond this time around. We've seen a much more conservative Pope from Pope Benedict so far.
Nancy Youssef, Daniel Dombey, Paul Richter. We'll be taking your calls right after this break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. By Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. And by LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Wes Anderson talks about directing his film Fantastic Mr. Fox. It's just been released on DVD and Blu-ray. Also, a look at the new world of American pet keeping. Michael Schaefer talks about his book One Nation Under Dog, Prozac popping puppies, dog park politics, and organic pet food. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Here's an email from JM, who says, I have a question for Daniel Dombey. China has slowed down its lending process to the U.S. and is threatening to liquidize the dollar, with the Fed printing more and more money and inflation the only thing holding up the value of the dollar. Is it possible the U.S. could be facing another market collapse in the near future?
I think you have to unpick that question. It's certainly true that China has slowed down its purchase of dollar treasuries in the last 3 or 4 months, and China is one of the biggest purchasers of U.S. debt. But let's just be a little bit calm about this. China has, I think, something like 10% of the U.S. outstanding debt. It doesn't have it all. China is invested in the U.S. It's dependent. Its richness depends on how much those holdings are worth. China doesn't want to destroy the U.S. Treasury. It doesn't want to destroy the U.S. economy. These are two countries which are in a very delicate dance with each other. Each is annoyed with the other one. But if they slam the door and walk away, each is going to regret it.
All right. Let's open the phones and go first to a caller in Bethesda, Maryland. Good morning, Mary Teresa. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm calling in regards to your guest the other day, the Reverend Thomas Doyle, who wrote the abuse story of the Catholic Church in 1985, and he told how severe it was in the United States and what it would cost the church to pay for it. He gave that report to Bernard Law, and Bernard Law returned to Boston and allowed the abuse to continue in his area for the next 8 years. Afterwards, he was run out of the United States and returned to Rome, where Cardinal Ratzinger, the head of the Sacred Congregation of Faith, gave him the St. Mary Major Church, and he said a mass for the Pope. It was the greatest insult to the victims of abuse in the United States. Bernard Law still continues in Rome, and that is that the Pope and the cardinals should be removed, and the bishops that have allowed this.
Thanks for calling, Mary Teresa. Strong feelings out there. How likely is it that this pope or any pope would be removed? Hasn't that happened only once back in 1500?
Officials in the Vatican are pretty much dismissing that possibility, and I don't think there's any sign that that may happen anywhere near the current situation.
Does it trouble people here in this country to see what's happening across Europe? I mean, what is the thinking across Europe? Is it the same as or different from the feelings here in the United States about pedophilia and the church, Daniel?
I think you have to look at individual countries. Ireland is obviously a country that is going through enormous trauma as these hundreds and hundreds of cases have come to light. We've had a lot of attention now in Germany as well, with many, many cases there as well. That's where when the current Pope was Archbishop of Munich at the back end of the 70s. And you've seen his popularity fall. I think you do see a church that isn't used to dealing with these questions. You have a society which in Europe is in many cases almost post-religious, and they're finding their way. I think they are finding their way. I think they could learn some examples from the U.S. case.
Nancy.
You know, I think in a way this has been a shakeup for the church, in that when the United States scandal broke, I distinctly remember that it was cast as an American problem. It was an overly aggressive American media coming after the church. So once it became now a European problem, they've lost that argument. And that's the dynamic that I find most interesting as this is unfolding. And I think it's in a way shaking up the church versus vice versa, in that it's not just an American problem, and there's not that ability to say that it's an American press coming after them or that it's strictly an American issue.
I'd just like to say I spoke to a good friend who's a thinking American Catholic about this, and he said, you know, this is another case where European moral superiority actually sometimes is. That sense of European moral superiority is a problem. Many Europeans do feel morally superior to the U.S. for whatever reason. And you don't just earn that by being European.
So what you're saying is that sense is being shaken.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They thought this was an example of a U.S. degeneracy, to be honest. And I think that is not only flipped, but wrong.
Interesting. To Brian, who's in Bethesda, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I think your panel sort of proves the point I wanted to make, and that is that the press does not even a bad job, it doesn't even attempt to really address the issues in Israel, Palestine, and the conflict. Your panel just went around, and none of them mentioned that these settlements are absolutely illegal under international law. There's no legal debate about this question, and U.S. policy has also said this. And then we've just had the remarkable statement that Netanyahu may have popular support because of the reception he had at AIPAC to the rafters, it was said, AIPAC doesn't even represent the American Jewish community. There's J Street, which is far more popular and far more in line with mainstream Jewish opinion. So my question is, why does the press not adequately address the Palestinian narrative, the legal narrative? Because I think Americans think this is an unsolvable problem, when really all there needs to be no negotiations. There certainly needs to be no peace. There's the Palestinians can't do anything. Israel must apply international law to itself, which is the right of return of refugees, the pulling out of the disputed territories, and to stop settling there.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think that it's fairly clear that it is indeed true that every U.S. administration is opposed in one way or another settlement activity in occupied territory. We always refer to occupied East Jerusalem, and the West Bank is also occupied territory. Those settlements are illegal, and it is an interesting case that meeting legal requirements is seen as a precondition or a step for negotiations. I agree. On the other hand, Israel has absolutely no inclination to do this if it isn't part of a process. And I think this whole issue is about finding a solution to a problem. So any expectation of unilateral Israeli activity to just stop settlements, I think, is likely to be deeply disappointed.
Paul Richter.
It's interesting to look at just Israeli opinion about building in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. The conservative side supporters of Netanyahu assert that the prime minister is on solid ground with building in these places. But a poll by the leading Israeli paper just a few days ago found, in fact, that Israeli opinion was split on this issue, that slightly more Israelis were in favor of building, but nearly as many thought that the government ought to just cut it out.
All right, let's go to Granger, Indiana. Good morning, Candy.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
I'm a first-time caller, so I'm a little nervous.
Well, I'm glad to have you with us. Thanks.
I just had a comment about the abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. I'm not a Catholic, but from the outside, it just appears to me that, you know, this is, if it's a crime, why is it not a crime just because you're in the Catholic Church? It should be pushed under the blanket and ignored.
Well,
yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm a medical professional, and if there is any indication of abuse or crime that I see when I'm working, I'm obligated to report it. Otherwise, I could be held accountable myself. It just seems that the head clergy of the church, if they're aware of it, they should be taking care of it.
It's an interesting point that somehow the clergy, because of ordination, because a place within the church is put into a different legal framework, and whether that might change going forward. What are your thoughts?
Who would be willing to confront the church to change it, to me, is the question. I mean, I think Candy raises a great point, but then who would have the political strength and willingness to confront the Catholic Church? I don't know that that's evident, and how would you go about doing that? You know, when I look at the scandal, I think Candy raises great points. I really see an institution that this happens not just in the church, but in large institutions, people protecting one another when crisis arises. I mean, we see that even on Capitol Hill, if there's a senator caught in a scandal, all of a sudden people are protecting one another, protecting their party. That's the dynamic that I see going on, more than sort of a legal barrier between the church and government. I mean, there's that, but I really see at the core a human instinct to protect one another in crisis.
All right. To Elmer, New Jersey. Good morning, Miles.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Go right ahead, sir.
I have a question about our sanctions or attempt to get sanctions against Iran. Why now, after X amount of years of Iran having a nuclear program, actually started under the Shah, are we pushing for such severe sanctions against Iran, which is another nation that wants nuclear arms in the Middle East. Israel has the fourth or fifth largest arsenal in the world. As a counterbalance to that, Iran wants one. They're stuck between Russia and Israel, two of the largest nuclear powers in the world. Why don't they have the right? And isn't our opposition to the program and our push for sanctions actually helping Ahmadinejad as much as our embargo against Cuba helped Castro maintain power all those years? Aren't we pushing all the fence-sitters in Iran who are neither with the opposition or with the government toward the government by, seeking punitive action against Ahmadinejad?
Thanks for your call, Miles. David Dombey. Sorry, Daniel.
There are two questions there, and I think they're very distinct. One, why does Iran not have the right for nuclear weapons? It's actually signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It says it doesn't want to develop nuclear weapons. It actually is forbidden under the terms of the treaty it has signed to develop nuclear weapons. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has said there are real questions and concerns that it could be working on ballistic missiles related to nuclear warheads. There are a whole series of questions that have not been answered. And even apart from the fears that Israel has, the Obama administration is terrified that if Iran develops a bomb, it will lead to proliferation throughout the region. That's why it's an issue. And we also had the Qom facility found out last year. Whether sanctions work, whether sanctions are counterproductive, that's a whole new ball game. That's a whole separate ball game.
Interesting question as to whether President Obama's agreement with President Medvedev on nuclear issues might affect this whole discussion with Iran. Paul Richter.
The Obama administration is saying that the agreement is a sign of better U.S.-Russian relations, that the reset they've been talking about is actually occurring. But, boy, if you look just in the past couple of weeks, the signals between the two capitals are very checkered. Hillary Clinton goes to Moscow and complains about how the Russians have now agreed, after long delays, to start working on the Bushehr reactor so that it can open up. In other words, from the American point of view, that's saying that at a time when we're trying to show Iran that it's isolated, the Russians are going to help them in a big way. So and these negotiations were much delayed over disagreements between the two countries. So not all sweetness and light.
Paul Richter of the L.A. Times and Tribune newspapers. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally to Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
It seems like every time there's negotiations going to be set up between Israel and the Palestinians, the Israelis have a way of stalling or doing something to put the Palestinians on the defense, such as the settlements that they want to build in East Jerusalem. And, Diane, we do have leverage against Israel. We give them $3 billion a year, and I think we could use that as a leverage. And I think we should maybe have sanctions on Israel, and hopefully the world community would go along, because it just seems that we never put any pressure on Israel. And then of course, Nancy Pelosi and Boehner are coming out yesterday and giving an undivided support to Israel, never criticizes Israel, the Congress never does. It's kind of undermining what Barack Obama's trying to do.
All right. Thanks for your call. First of all, is $3 billion correct? I thought it was more like 10.
I think $3 billion a year in military assistance
okay.
is correct.
Go ahead. Paul Richter, do you want to respond?
It certainly is revealing that at a time when the president is at a standoff with the Israeli government, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is able to go to Capitol Hill and get unequivocal support from Democrats as well as Republicans. And that's a sign of how Obama is going to be hemmed in if this dispute keeps on much longer.
Nancy?
You know, I think Richard really gets at what are the limits and capabilities of the United States vis-a-vis its relationship with Israel. It's certainly been tested this week. But I think one of the things we have to think about is there's this undercurrent of domestic politics, both from the Israeli side and the United States side, that is always pushing the negotiations. So we talked about sort of getting up to a line and then things stopping. It's an undercurrent that we don't maybe discuss as much that is driving a lot of this. This is as much a political issue as it is anything else, and I think we have to look at it in that context.
I wonder if some line has been crossed here, Daniel.
Well, I think there's another line here, which is you've got a U.S. which is in two wars and facing in Iran and is and has a fiscal crunch and is looking more for its allies to help militarily. And it's looking for an awful lot more for its Arab allies to help in dealing with Iran and dealing with security. That changes the balance in terms of the relations with Israel. They have to look for Arab approval in many issues.
Daniel Dombey of Financial Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, Paul Richter of the LA Times, and Tribune Newspapers, thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.